In the novel series The Lord of the Rings by J.R.R. Tolkien, the city of Gondor has been without a king for 1,000 years. Stewards rule in his place, but over the years their leadership has fallen into decline. Evil has grown strong, and it seems like all hope is lost. But into that hopeless situation, the king returns. A man who seemed to be no one special is revealed to be the true king of Gondor, and with his return, hope is restored and the white tree blooms again. Though this is just a story, it strikes a chord deep in our souls because it represents the hope that we all long for. It rings true because we long for a king to come and save us from all that is sick and wrong in this world. It is this hope for the return of the king that Paul begins to talk about next in his first letter to the Thessalonians. As I hope you'll remember, Paul wrote this letter to the young church in Thessalonica. Despite their short time together, this group of Jews and Gentiles had put their trust in Jesus and quickly grew in their faith. When Paul was kicked out of the city by an angry mob, he was desperate to know how they were doing. So he sent Timothy to find out and discovered that they were holding up strong in the face of severe persecution. For the first 3 chapters of the book, Paul tells this story and practically glows with pride. Starting in chapter 4, he gets down to business. First, he reminds them to treat their bodies with holiness and honor, especially in the realm of sexual temptation. Next, he reminds them to love each other deeply and work hard so that they can take care of each other. None of this is new. He's just reminding them of what they already knew from what he taught them before and that he had learned from Jesus. In the section we're going to look at today, Paul turns from these general reminders of things that they already knew to a specific problem that they were facing in their church. I'm guessing that when Timothy showed up in Thessalonica, they had some burning questions that they couldn't wait to ask Paul. Timothy brought the questions back to Paul, and Paul is answering their questions through this letter. The question is this: Paul, you told us that Jesus is going to return to rule as king. You told us that all death is going to die and we will rule with him in eternity, and it sounded like that was going to happen really soon. But my wife just died, and she, like me, believed that she was going to live forever with Jesus, and now I am sad, and I don't know what to believe. What is my hope for her supposed to be? And what is the hope for me as I begin to realize that I too will likely die before Jesus returns? How do I hold in tension this amazing hope that I have for the future and this intense pain that I am going through right now? And by the way, when is he coming back anyhow? Paul answers this first question about the resurrection of the dead in chapter 4, verses 13 through 18, which we'll look at today, and the second question about timing in chapter 5, which we will look at with Jordan next week. In this section, Paul is going to be talking about the return of Jesus. Whenever we start talking about these things, we have a tendency to want to know all the details. I want to know when it will happen and how it will happen and how will I know when it's about to happen. We want to know the details. We want to know if this or that current world leader is the Antichrist and if COVID-19 could be one of the bowls of wrath from Revelation. Unfortunately, Paul is not writing this to answer those questions. He starts out, though, with telling us his purpose. In verse 13, he says this: "But we do not want you to be uninformed, brothers, about those who are asleep, that you may not grieve as others do who have no hope." Paul is writing this because some of the Thessalonian believers have died, and the Thessalonians are grieving. This brings up a big theological question. Paul had told them that Jesus was going to return and make all death die. But it had sounded like that was going to come quickly, So they had not really thought about the fact that some of them, and most likely all of them, would actually die before he returned. Would they miss out on the resurrection? And it also brings up a practical question. How do we as Christians deal with grief? Bad stuff happens in this life, and people that we love die. We miss them deeply, and we grieve. But Jesus called us to joy. What are we to do emotionally with this pain that we feel? Let's tackle the second question before we get on to the first. Paul says that we do not grieve as those who have no hope. In their culture, pagan religion and philosophy offered no hope for life after death. Life after death for the Greeks was a non-physical existence in the underworld. It was a dim, shadowy half-life. If you were a great hero, you maybe could go into a sort of paradise. Truly terrible people could get punished for eternity, but most people were headed for a mere shadowy half-life. This offered very little emotional comfort. People were terrified of death. Modern material humanism is no better. Your body is all there is. You are just a random accumulation of energy and molecules. After you die, you just cease to exist. There is no life after death, so let's do our best to make the most out of life today. This sounds really modern, but there were a group of Greek philosophers who were saying exactly the same thing 2,000 years ago. This also, though, offers no true hope. Life today is hard. If death is just the end, my life feels really meaningless. Paul says that we do not grieve like those who have no hope. We have a strong hope for the future. We do not have to grieve in a hopeless way. Some have taken this to mean that Christians should not grieve. Since we know that I will be with Mary again someday, I don't have to be sad today. The reality is that that just doesn't work. In this verse, Paul is saying that we grieve differently, not that we don't grieve. Failing to grieve means cutting off our emotions and burying our grief. This is psychologically harmful to us and does not honor those that we have lost. Grieving is missing those that we have lost. We miss seeing them and being with them. We have to go through the pain and feel the sadness that death brings. It's vital to our healing. Jesus walks with us through that process and gives amazing hope to us in the process, but that doesn't make it easy. We grieve because we love deeply. Christian grief is a beautiful and necessary thing. So what exactly is this hope of the future that gives meaning to my grief? I think for a lot of us, we have a picture of the future that is not much different than Paul's Greek contemporaries. Much of our imagination about heaven is actually based on Greek philosophy and medieval art. We imagine disembodied souls floating around on clouds playing harps. We imagine a praise and worship night that goes on forever and ever with no end. Now, I don't know about you, but that feels more like hell than heaven. I could sing of your love forever, but if I have to sing this chorus one more time, I might scream. A lot of popular hymns feed these ideas. I'll fly away, O glory, is such a catchy song, but it feeds this idea of us all flying away off to heaven and leaving this world and all its physical problems behind. That idea has much more to do with Plato than it does with Paul. So if that isn't the biblical vision of our future destination, what is? Let's see what Paul has to say here. In verses 14 to 15, he says this, "For since we believe that Jesus died and rose again, even so, through Jesus, God will bring with him those who have fallen asleep. For this we declare to you by a word from the Lord, that we who are alive, who are left until the coming of the Lord, will not precede those who have fallen asleep." The first important word that we need to understand here is the coming of the Lord. In Greek, this is a very specific word, parousia. Parousia is the word that is used when the king or an emperor comes to visit a city. If Xi Jinping or Donald Trump comes to visit you, that is parousia. In other words, when referring to Jesus, we're talking about the return of the king. It's about when Jesus, who has gone away from his physical presence in this world, will one day return to take up physical kingship in this world again. We also see in this passage that God will bring with him those who have fallen asleep. What does this mean? At first, it looks like he will bring back with him the souls of those who have died who are in heaven with him. Maybe true, but a second look makes this not likely what he's trying to say here. This phrase, bring with him those who have fallen asleep, is in parallel with Jesus who died and rose again. The implication is not that he's bringing back souls from heaven, but that he is bringing our bodies out of the grave. Just like he physically rose from the dead, we also will rise with him in a physical resurrection. The biblical hope of resurrection is the physical recreation of our bodies into this physical world made new. Heaven is not out there somewhere. Heaven is coming here. The biblical imagination of our future home is all about this world made new. It's about a new Eden in which we will rule alongside Jesus. It's about the new Jerusalem coming down to this world where we will live in harmony with each other and in the light of the glory of Jesus. Heaven is not the place we will go to. Heaven is what will happen to us here. This is a strong hope. There is no boredom when I think about this. Can you imagine? 10,000 years singing songs could get a bit old. But 10,000 years exploring and learning and growing without the problems of sin? Getting to live out the full potential that God made for me when my brain doesn't get old and stop working? When my body just keeps getting stronger and I finally get to free solo on El Capitan because I'm not afraid and I can't die and I've got all the time in the world to work up to it and Jesus is there hanging out with me as I do it? It's when I finally get to learn all the languages I'll never have time to learn and talk to all the people I've wanted to meet and read all the books I wish I could have read and build some bridges and finally learn all that I want to about neuroscience and horticulture. And most beautifully, in all that I get to do it in the presence of Jesus with the people that I love. Our hope in the resurrection is glorious and beautiful and so much stronger than anything ancient or modern philosophy have to offer us. If you want to learn more about our hope of the resurrection and all that means to us, I recommend two books, Heaven by Randy Elkhorn and Surprised by Hope by N.T. Wright. These two books have made a huge impact in my own hope of resurrection. And I believe that that is the hope that Paul is holding out to the Thessalonians here. Paul is reminding the Thessalonians that they have this deep hope that one day Jesus will return, bringing his kingdom to earth in its total completion, and that they will reign with him here for eternity. But what about those who already died? What about my wife or my sister or my daughter who just died? When Paul described it, it sounded like Jesus' return was going to happen any day. Their imagination was all about Jesus gathering up and sorting out the living people. What about the dead ones? In verse 15 to 16, Paul says this, "For this we declare to you by a word from the Lord, that we who are alive, who are left until the coming of the Lord, will not precede those who have fallen asleep. For the Lord himself will descend from heaven with a cry of command, with the voice of an archangel, and with the sound of the trumpet of God, and the dead in Christ will rise first. Then we who are alive, who are left, will be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air, and so we will always be with the Lord." The hope that Paul is holding out to the Thessalonians, who have recently lost their loved ones, is that when Jesus returns, the first thing that will happen is that all the dead will be resurrected. Our imagination of that day should not be flying off to go join my loved ones in the clouds. Instead, the biblical image is of our beloved dead ones standing next to us once again, more fully alive than they ever were before, as we invite Jesus back to earth as our King. But doesn't this passage say that we will go meet him in the air? What is that all about? Paul says, "Then we who are alive, who are left, will be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air." Many have taught that there are actually two returns of Jesus. First, he will snatch up all the believers out of the earth to heaven, saving them from having to endure 7 years of terrible final tribulation. Then Jesus will return with them to destroy evil and set up his kingdom. This has been a very common view in recent years, made popular by a series of novels. It's commonly called the Rapture. This view is mostly supported by this verse and is at first glance what this seems to be saying. The first reason I think this idea of pre-tribulation rapture doesn't hold up is because it does not seem to be in character with the nature of God. When else in the Bible does God save his people from going through tribulation? He doesn't. He walks with them through it. He lets his people go through suffering, but he walks with them through it. He makes them victorious in their suffering, not by saving them from their suffering. Also, if we take some time to look at the original language, we'll see that this wasn't really what Paul was trying to communicate. The phrase, "meet the Lord," that Paul uses here is a very specific Greek word that is used only two other times in the New Testament. The word is apantesis. Apantesis is the idea of a royal welcoming party. It's always used to describe going out of a city to welcome the king or another important person and welcome them back into the city. It's used of when 5 of the 10 virgins go out to meet the bridegroom and welcome him back into the wedding feast. It's also used in Acts of the Roman Christians when they go out of the city to meet Paul and bring him back into Rome. The idea here is not of God snatching us up out of the world to a heavenly storage place. Instead, the idea is of going up into the clouds and greet him and ushering him back to this world as the rightful king. It's kind of a reverse of Matthew 28, when Jesus gathers his disciples together and goes away into the clouds of heaven. Now he gathers us up to him in the clouds, and we together with him enter this new perfected world together. All that to say, I think that we can summarize the biblical hope of resurrection like this. One day, in a date which we cannot predict, Jesus will return in glory for the whole world to see. It'll be the loudest event in history with cries and calls and trumpets. There will be no hiding this event. And when he returns, the dead will all come out of their graves and will all be gathered together to meet him, where he'll judge the good and the bad and the ugly, not based on how good we are, but on our allegiance to Jesus as the King. And all that is sinful and evil in us and in this world will be burned up, and we who confess him as King will reign beside him in perfect bodies in our perfect world forever. Paul concludes this amazing passage in this way. Verse 18 says, "Therefore, encourage one another with these words." In this short phrase, Paul loops us back to the beginning. When we feel like giving up, when we grieve for those who have lost, when we look at all the pain that sin and death have brought into this world, don't forget where this is all heading. Yes, we grieve. We deeply grieve. We miss those who have died. We cry, and in their absence with us here, it leaves us with a gaping hole in our lives. But we do not grieve like those who have no hope. We will see them again. We will hold them again and talk with them again and throw the football around with them again. And the time we will have been without them will seem as nothing in the end. And all our tears will be wiped from our eyes. Lord Jesus, come quickly. In the midst of our pain, give us hope. Help us to hold on to this amazing promise of resurrection, that though we suffer and that though we grieve, this grief is not forever. That even in the midst of this grief, we have hope. That our tears would be mixed with joy. And that in our hope-filled grieving, the whole world would see your glory. Amen. Before I give you a few discussion questions, let me say one thing. I believe that what I have shared with you today is true and biblical, but it is not the only opinion on these things. There are a wide variety of interpretations of these things. Let's talk about it. Let's debate about it. Let's even get a little worked up about it, but let's love each other well in the discussion. And let's not forget the most important point that we all agree on, that Jesus will return and make all things new. Here's a few questions to discuss. Who or what do you grieve for recently? And second question, how does this hope of resurrection help you in your grief?